Cars today are built to last, but how they look is up to you, and that's where Maaco comes in. They specialize in cosmetic repairs. Let's say it's affordable paint jobs to fixing those annoying dents and dings. Whatever it is, Maaco has you covered. With more Americans keeping their cars longer, now's the time to protect your investment and keep it looking sharp for years. Get started. Visit your local Maaco today. Get the free estimate and see how easy it is to bring new life to your ride. Uh-oh, better get Maaco.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
In 2026 and beyond, we're expecting to hear lots more of this.
Across the line, he gets close, he just hangs on in a superb finish to the line. It was decided for third place by 53 thousandths of a second.
With more overtaking opportunities and closer wheel-to-wheel battles, the FIA's new for 26 regulations are designed to create even more thrilling Formula One racing.
Clearly, my hope is that it will be very competitive out of the box. My hope is we'll have different teams winning and periods when they go up and down and so on. Invariably, with new rules, there will be somebody who gets it wrong and who finds themselves in a rather embarrassing spot to start with. But I do think we're putting some things together to make sure it's more competitive in the long run.
Overseeing Formula One's new rules is the FIA's Nicholas Tombassis, a man who knows exactly what it takes to maximise performance within the regulations. During 25 years as an aerodynamicist, he won multiple world titles with Ferrari and Benetton.
At some point I started thinking that's far too easy, it's not really that challenging. No matter what we do, we win. In later stages of my career, I was thinking how stupid was I to be thinking that wins are easy and guaranteed, because obviously I went through other phases of my career when wins were not coming, and then that was really, really tough. So I felt, you know, that I didn't appreciate the wins when they were happening so easily.
Hello and welcome to F1 Beyond the Grid. I'm Tom Clarkson, and my guest this week is the FIA's Director of Single-Seaters, Nicholas Tombassis. He and his team at the FIA are introducing new regulations that will transform the sport from 2026. Formula One cars will be lighter and more agile, engines will have more power, they'll be fueled sustainably, and new aerodynamic innovations will be introduced. So what exactly will Formula One cars look like under the new regulations, and how will they create better competition, improve safety, and greater sustainability? Nicholas provides an in-depth explanation of the key changes and how they'll achieve a greater spectacle. We also delve into his career on the other side of the fence, with the teams. A specialist in aerodynamics, Tombassis' expertise contributed to 15 drivers and constructors titles during his time at Benetton and Ferrari. He talks about what it was like winning the majority of those with Michael Schumacher, why Fernando Alonso not becoming champion at Ferrari is one of his biggest regrets, and the funny dreams he has about the end of the 2010 season when Alonso fell agonizingly short of the title. We also discuss his time at McLaren, his memories of working with Kimi Raikkonen, and much, much more. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Nicholas, great to have you on the show. How are you?
I'm okay. Thanks. It's my pleasure.
Now, you've had a fascinating career in Formula One, 25-ish years on the team side of things, winning races, winning world championships. You're now with the FIA. Just how different is life with the regulator?
Very different. After all, we are still doing something that we are very fortunate. We are all passionate about it, whether we are on the FIA side or the team side, I guess. So everyone up and down the paddock, I think, is quite passionate. But of course, the perspective changes. We don't get, as FIA, the adrenaline of winning a race. You know, that is unrivaled in many ways when you do win a race. But we do get satisfaction if the championship is working well, if there's an exciting competition, if things are running smoothly and fairly. So all of that does give me, at least, and I know a lot of my colleagues, a big satisfaction as well.
You are the ultimate poacher turned gamekeeper, aren't you? It requires a very different approach by the sounds of it.
Yes, although quite a few of my colleagues in the FA have been also poachers as well, and they've joined us on the bright side of the moon. I think when you have done that side, I think you understand also their side a bit better. And we hear their issues, their complaints. And sometimes, many times, I think, well, yes, if I was sat on their side of the fence, I would be probably saying the same thing. You have to see things from a slightly different perspective when you're doing this job, yes.
Do you feel like you're the headmaster now?
I don't know if it's headmaster is the right word, but I do feel some responsibility, yes.
Well, we're talking at the Canadian Grand Prix. Big weekend for the FIA because you've just announced the 2026 technical regulations. Big picture first. What are the aims of those regs?
Well, first of all, let me say what we announced today is what will be submitted to the World Council. So they're still not yet formally regs. They need to be discussed in the World Council and then approved by them, which hasn't happened yet. And that's by no means a foregone conclusion. We're going to be discussing that a lot with them in a few days' time. And then we're going to be submitting the final regs to them before the end of June. And then, of course, they will have to vote, and we need to see what that happens. The aims are to, first of all, make sure that we have close racing. It's important to have exciting racing and have cars that can follow each other very closely, where the driver is still fighting for position with another driver. And we feel that that has deteriorated a bit recently on the current cars.
Can I ask you why you think that's been the case with the current cars? Why it's been harder to follow?
We think we understand the reasons. Certain aspects of the aerodynamic regulations of the current cars, we didn't guard as closely as we could have or should have. And that has opened the space for some solutions which have worsened the wake and hence mean that the car following loses more downforce than it should, and hence cannot follow as closely, and so on and so forth. Now, we believe we've understood the reasons, and we think that with the regulations we are putting in place for 2026, we can avoid that, and that, therefore, cars will be able to follow each other much more closely. We do feel the current cars have a bit too much downforce. There's many corners that are no longer corners. They're flat out, and for more places of the track to be what we call grip limited, to be basically corners. We are making a car that is compatible with the engine regulations, that which are already approved about a couple of years ago. And these make a step towards sustainability. So we feel that is very important as a first step of Formula One. It's by no means the step. We still need to do more work there. So all of these factors have pushed us towards the current package of regulations.
And when you look at that package, can we say whether the cars will be what? A similar lap time to where we are now? A little bit slower? What do you think?
Well, the car we've got on our simulations today is a bit slower, but not by much, maybe a couple of seconds or that sort of thing. But we are continuing to engage with the teams a lot, and we will be also discussing various measures that maybe will be increasing performance by a bit. So in that, I don't expect it to be a night and day difference. I think it's going to be in the ballpark. Some circuits a bit faster, some circuits a bit slower, but in the ballpark.
And when you're thinking up new regulations, how important is it that Formula One cars remain the fastest in the world point to point?
It's difficult to say because we don't really race against other cars on the same venue in order to be able to say. Clearly, Formula One has to be the pinnacle of the sport. It is not that difficult to make a car that is faster if one wants. You know, we have a lot of regulations that limit how fast a car can go. We can, you know, within 2 days, write regulations that make the cars go faster by 20 seconds a lap almost, if you know what I mean. So it's not the speed, the lap time isn't really a be-all, end-all. We want the cars to be challenging to drive, to be a test for the best drivers in the world. But to actually make a car that's faster is not so difficult if you're not limited by regulations.
Let's get into the nuts and bolts of it now. The power units first, as you say, that's been settled for quite a while now. But what are the main differences for 2026 compared to what we're using now?
Well, the power unit has quite a lot lower power on the actual internal combustion part. We go down from about 550 to about 400 kilowatts, whereas the electrical part increases by a lot. We go from 120 to 350, so we're 50-50 almost between internal combustion power and electrical power. That is one key big difference. In that process, we have removed MGUH, which is the device that was converting some of the exhaust energy into electrical energy. We've done that mainly for simplicity and to reduce some of the complexity of the engines. We wanted that in order to make sure we can attract newcomers to the sport, which I think has been reasonably successful. And finally, of course, the sustainable fuels. That is a major step. The fuels in 2026 will be fully sustainable, which, as I said before, is one of the big steps towards sustainability, although by no means the definitive step.
So in terms of total power output, similar to where we are now?
No, actually a bit higher than where we are now, yes. It's going to be approximately up by, about 100 horsepower or so.
Just out of interest, if you put that new power unit into one of the current cars, current chassis, current dimensions, what would happen?
That wouldn't be a very good idea, because much as the maximum power has gone up, because a lot of it is electrical, that cannot last for so long. And therefore, towards the end of the straights, we need to have cars with lower drag, lower aerodynamic drag, which is what these technical regulations have done today. And the current generation cars have a bit too high a drag and therefore would suffer some velocity drop-off towards the end of the straights on the current cars. We believe we've solved this problem for the new cars.
Well, beautiful segue into talking about the new chassis for 26. How different? Give us some dimensions. How different are they going to be to what we're used to?
Well, cars will be smaller in dimensions. They will be narrower by about 10 centimeters. They will be shorter by about 20 centimeters. They will be lighter by about 30 kilos, which is the first time the weight has gone down in Formula One since the 80s, I believe. The wheels will be a bit narrower, not very much, but a bit. So basically, we're putting the whole sport a bit on a diet.
And you're achieving that reduction in drag on the straights through adjustable aerodynamics?
Yes, adjustable aerodynamics. So we will have what we call the X mode and the Z mode. The Z mode is when there's a lot of downforce around the corners, and the X mode is when the wings move and we have a low drag setting for the straights. But inherently, even the Z mode of the cars has much lower drag than what the current generation cars has. So then it's even more so when we go to the X mode.
Just for people to try and understand, the adjustable aero at the rear, is that actually going to be quite similar to what we're used to with DRS?
Yes, in many ways it will look very similar to the DRS for the spectators. But there will be also the front wing will be moving as well in order to keep the car in a reasonably balanced state on the straights.
So in a similar manner, what the
flaps? Well, the flaps will reduce incidence, and we are discussing a bit with the teams the best way to do that. There's a few different options on the table still.
Okay, and at the minute, DRS is an overtaking tool, whereas, tell me if I'm wrong, this adjustable aero will happen on every straight over a certain length. So what about overtaking?
First of all, yes, you're right. The adjustable aero will happen on almost every straight. There are some straights in the championship where this will not be allowed if we want the top speeds not to be excessive. Some speeds, some places like, say, Monaco, we will not allow those flaps to open in order to keep the speeds in a reasonable level. We will be achieving a very similar effect to the DRS with the electrical part of the engine. Cars that are within 1 second of the front car will have a bit more energy to recover, and they will be also able to use a bit more power on the straights. So we believe that effect is very, very comparable to the DRS.
And safety? It's interesting that the cars are going to be lighter, yet I believe safer as well. How have you managed that?
Well, we are changing a few things on safety, evolution rather than revolution. The biggest one is the size of the chassis. Currently, cars have a what was called a Xylon panel. It's been on the car since 2000-ish. I forget exactly which year it was introduced. This is bonded onto the chassis after it gets made, and it's to reduce the chance of some other object penetrating the chassis. We are now replacing that and the current sidewall of the chassis with an integrated panel, which is much more tough but also lighter. That's one step. The other big one for safety is the nose. We are making it in such way that if the car gets a glancing blow onto the wall, the nose will not just all snap off and then leave the chassis with no nose at all. A bit will remain. And so if the car takes a glancing blow and then bounces on the other side of a track and gets onto the wall again, it will still have some structure there to protect the driver.
Talking of drivers, one of the complaints, particularly in years one and two of the current regulations, was the ride of the cars. Obviously, it varied from car to car, but one of the ideas, I think it was George Russell came up with it, was why don't we try active suspension? Did you even consider that with the 26 regs?
We did consider it. It never got that far, but we did consider it. It was one option. We believe we are solving this issue with the aerodynamic characteristics of the cars. We believe that the cars that we will see in 26 will be slightly less prone to hug the ground and will be running a bit higher. And we believe that will mean that they can run a bit softer and solve those complaints.
I'm talking to the poacher in you now, Nicholas. The man who was at the teams, can you envisage any loopholes? Do you think the teams are going to find anything? Do you actively keep some grey areas just to see what people do, to give people a bit of freedom?
We don't think that loopholes are very good for the sport. They make good reading when somebody comes up with that, and it gives engineers a very good level of satisfaction that they've interpreted the rules in a different way. But we think it is important for people to be playing by the same rule book and to be playing by the same way they understand the rules. So we take a much higher effort nowadays to try to make sure we close all the loopholes. So I don't believe there's any, but clearly there will be some minus here or there, but I think we're doing a reasonable job to try to keep them all closed.
Nicholas, you've worked in Formula One for so long. I think it was 1992 you came in with Benetton. Since then, what has been the most rewarding set of regulations that you've worked on?
For me, the fondest memories, of course, are the 2007-2008 period, I guess. But that's not so much because the regulations were that much better or worse. It's just because the results were very good for me and for the team I was working for. And on that basis, that's my fondest area. It's difficult to detach your satisfaction from how well your car is doing, because 2009 was a terrible year, for example, and I can't ever say I have fond memories out of that.
That was your second stint at Ferrari you've just referred to there. But Nicholas, is there a little bit of you even now that wishes you were on the other side of the fence and able to, you know, get your teeth into these 26 regs?
Yes, sure. I mean, as I say, there's big differences in my current role and my previous role, and pluses and minuses. Ultimately, everybody in Formula One is a competitive person. So am I. I do miss the competition some part. I think it's a matter of trying to think of the bigger picture, and I really enjoy what I'm doing. But yes, some part of the competition, the adrenaline when you do win, you do miss a bit.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand-new luxury apartments. River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments. River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Let's go even further back now, because you were born in Athens, your father was an architect, your grandfather was an explorer. And is it true that your grandfather's seen a Yeti?
My grandfather always used to tell me that story when I was a kid. And I must say, from my very early age, I was admiring it. Then I was thinking, you know, it must be a bit dodgy. And then I read his memoirs, and he did actually put it in a different picture. He thought that what he saw, because my grandfather was going up the Himalayas a lot, so the venue was right. It wasn't, he didn't see it, you know.
When you say Himalayas, are you talking Everest or?
No, Everest wasn't yet conquered by the when my grandfather was climbing up there. I think Everest happened in 1950 something, and my grandfather was doing that in 1920 something or 30, so it was a bit before. So they hadn't gone up to the Everest. They were going up, I think, reasonably high up, I think 8,000 meters and stuff. He had seen some creature, which in his memoirs he said he thought was a hermit, a local hermit, so a human who was some Buddhist hermit of some sort, and not a monster or anything. But, well, journalists back then were like today's journalists. They basically would inflate stories and bring them out of proportion. So when apparently he went back down to the base camp, by that time, you know, and it was weeks later or whatever, the story had blown out of proportion, and it was like he'd seen a monster and stuff like that. But in his book, what he says, actually, he believes it was a human that was about, I don't know, a couple of hundred, on a valley in other side that he hadn't seen. So I think his real story is probably actually quite more mundane than the...
Well, it's still a great story, because to be climbing in the Himalayas in the 20s was quite something.
Yeah.
Intrepid.
Yeah.
How did you end up in Formula One with those influences on you?
I guess probably more relevant is the story of my dad than my grandfather, because my dad, as you say, was an architect, quite a successful one, and there was a lot of designing in my house. I guess as a kid, I was quite big-headed, I guess, and stubborn, and everybody used to tell me, oh, you know, you're going to be an architect when you grow up. And for me, that was almost like saying, you shouldn't be an architect. And I didn't want to do what my dad was doing, because I felt it was too easy or too much what people would do. So at that time, I had started watching Formula One a lot. I was a huge fan when I was about 10 years old. And so I decided I would be an engineer instead. So that's why. Now, incidentally, also when I started watching Formula One, it was when Colin Chapman had his ground effect cars and so on. So for me, that was what attracted me very much to aerodynamics.
You ended up at Trinity College, Cambridge. How did your time there inspire you?
Well, there was already on an engineering path. So I didn't know it at the time, but they were amongst the most carefree years of my life. One didn't have to worry about too much. One had to just study a bit hard, which one had to study. But other than that, it was quite a nice life, college life, you know, parties and stuff, and a bit of studying.
But a lot of studying, because funnily enough, James Allison was at Cambridge as well. And he says that intellectually, he was stretched more at Cambridge than at any other time in his life. Was it the same for you?
No, I don't think so. I think my subsequent career is more intellectually stretched, because it's always, you know, you're amongst some really smart people. Whether you're designing a car, you have to design a car better than other people who are really good at it. or when you're working in my current job, you have to try to predict the trends from people designing cars or whatever. So I don't think I would call it more stretched there. I think it was more relaxed in many ways.
So you go to Benetton, 1992. How did that job come up?
I think there was an ad in Autosport. I had already had one interview with McLaren for a job, which I hadn't got. There were not that many opportunities because back then teams were much smaller. So I gave it all I could, and I guess I was a bit lucky because I think it always takes a bit of luck where you are, no matter what you do. And I think I was in the right place, the right moment, and I managed to get all that.
Can I ask you a bit more about luck? Do you not think you make your own luck?
The way I see it, it's always a function of three things. One is your capacity, your talent or whatever. Then another one is hard work. And the third one is luck. I think you need all three. I don't think who says there's no luck in it. I don't believe it. I mean, I think there's always a bit of luck somewhere.
Well, you'd been promoted to head of aero at Benetton by the time Michael Schumacher was winning his world titles there. And you were working alongside people like Rory Byrne, Ross Brawn. Just tell us what it was like to work with those guys. Did you feel invincible in those mid-90s?
Certainly not invincible, no. What I think happens to a lot of people, and happened to me, is when everything is going every year slightly better than the previous year, you do get this feeling of invincibility, but invariably you always get some thump at some stage and you land on your bum if you're lucky, and then you have to think that you're human as well. And I've had these bumps, and sometimes I see other people around in this paddock who have not had these bumps and who behave as if they are invincible, and other people who have, and you see how it changes people.
What about working with Schumacher? What made him different?
Well, he was the first driver I had, because when I joined Benetton, he was already there a year before me. And it was always so special to work with him because he was so intense. He was really highly talented. He was highly intelligent as well. And he did appreciate the team, I think. So I always found him very polite and very, very nice, notwithstanding the fact he was such a superstar.
You win those two titles at Benetton in 94, 95. You then go and have your first stint at Ferrari. You guys all seem to move together, including Ross and Rory. And then you win the world title with Ferrari after a couple of near misses in 2000. And I remember Jean Todt saying that he whispered to Michael on the podium at Suzuka in 2000, "Our lives will never be the same again." Was it the same for you?
I guess so. Suzuka 2000 was absolutely phenomenal. It's one of the things that still makes my hair stand up. Yeah, I can associate with those words. I wasn't aware of this quote, but fair enough. Yes.
Why was Suzuka 2000 so phenomenal? Was it the emotion of the moment? Was it the achievement? Or was it just everything?
A bit of both. And Ferrari back then had not won a driver's championship since 1979. That was, 21 years, and they were getting extremely desperate. And the whole pressure there, everything, you could feel it, you could touch the pressure every day.
But how does that manifest itself? How do you feel it?
Well, you feel it because some people express it as pessimism, we're never going to win, some people...
But is it pressure on you in the aero department? Nicholas, we need another 20 points of downforce, go.
That's standard, and I think that's standard in most Formula One teams. I think in Italy and in Ferrari it was times 10, and that was the sort of pressure. Then clearly we knew we had the best driver, so we had no excuses, so we had to deliver. When finally we made it against competition like McLaren, which were no fools, that was just an unspeakable satisfaction.
And once you'd achieved that win, were you able to enjoy your time in Maranello a little bit more once the pressure was off?
I guess you get in a place where, you've seen that in periods of domination, Red Bull recently, or Mercedes for certain periods, or Red Bull before that, where you can all calm down a bit and then always think a bit more long-term and not short-term. And I think that was the main thing. That's what happens in these teams, that when they get into a period of domination, they don't have to worry about the next race. They don't have to worry about somebody saying, you know, you're an idiot, what on earth are you doing? Because, you know, we've just won, therefore nobody says you're an idiot. That means that you can calm down and concentrate on maybe next year's car or a research program or whatever, and not have to worry about, do I have a new front wing for the next race? And that does, I think, then enable you to somehow extend your advantage, which is what happened in 2001 and 2 and 3, for example, and perhaps what you see in other periods of domination of other teams.
How different is life at Ferrari compared to the British race teams? Because obviously we've talked about Benetton. We'll come on to McLaren, your time there as well. Is it purely the pressure, or is there something different about Ferrari with its storied history? And
it is very different. It felt very different back then, and I suspect it's still like that now. It's a national team. In Italy, they have the newspaper, the Gazzetta dello Sport, that pink newspaper that you see around. That's probably the most widely read newspaper anywhere nowadays, where everything is on the internet. That newspaper is in every bar in Italy. When you go to have your coffee in the bar, everyone wants to read that newspaper. There's one copy there, and somebody's reading it usually, and then you're waiting for him to finish, and you grab it before somebody else does. And every day, there's a whole page in Formula One, and usually half of that is on Ferrari. So that's a sort of pressure. So that means there's extreme scrutiny. When things are going well, you get almost a godlike feedback. And when things are going badly, you get slaughtered. So that creates the pressure. Yeah.
As a bit of an aside, what advice would you give Lewis Hamilton, who's going there in 2025, just how to deal with Ferrari?
It's difficult to know, because he has dealt with a lot of pressure in his career as well. He's always been in an Anglo-Saxon, say, environment, and now he needs to go there and prove he can still win races and win races with them. So I don't think he's waiting for my advice, but I think he can do fine there.
Don't read Gazzetta, probably.
Yeah, probably. Yeah,
it's probably a good one. Yeah.
Or read it only when he wins a race.
I remember that era being told by everyone at Ferrari that one of your biggest advantages was having everything under one roof, engine, chassis, all being manufactured together. Did you feel that?
Yes, for sure. I did feel that having everything under one roof back then was a big advantage, more than it would be nowadays, I would say. Nowadays, the packaging of the engine is much more controlled than it was back then. Nowadays, we make rules in such a way that you can... customer teams don't have a big disadvantage for having an engine. But back then, I think it was quite a big and important advantage, yes.
Did you feel that once you'd got it right there, you were set on a journey that was pretty unstoppable because of everything you had with you?
Yes, and I did feel that. And I guess I also felt rather stupidly that it was too easy at some point. So at some point, I started thinking, that's far too easy. It's not really that challenging. No matter what we do, we win. And that's what prompted me to look elsewhere for a while. And I thought that wins were just almost guaranteed. In later stages of my career, I was thinking, how stupid was I to be thinking that wins are easy and guaranteed? Because obviously I went through other phases of my career when wins were not coming, and then that was really, really tough. So I felt, you know, that I didn't appreciate the wins when they were happening so easily.
Fernando Alonso has said that about his wins in the mid-2000s when he won the championship. He's now, very recently, he's just said, I wish I'd appreciated the victories more and celebrated more at the time, because you win a race, you win a championship, and you're immediately thinking about the next one, whereas he wished he'd paused and just enjoyed the moment.
Yes, I can associate with that. I mean, as I say, I felt they were too easy. Back then, I wasn't traveling for races. I was mainly factory-based because I was like head of aero, and we were doing all the work in the wind tunnel. So I would watch races on television. Of course, my kids were quite young at that time, so I was also quite tired, as any father of young kids. So usually I would end up falling asleep on a race, because the moment Michael would overtake a few people and be on the lead after the first laps and then have a five-second lead, after that, it felt okay, a job done. And sometimes I'd wake up with the national anthem at the end.
Did that inspire your decision to leave and to go to McLaren?
It did, to a large extent. And as I say, afterwards, I thought, well, what an idiot I was. Yeah.
Well, I've already asked you about Maranello and having everything under one roof. And when he went to McLaren, the new factory, the MTC, had just been opened by Queen Elizabeth and Norman Foster designed, looked spectacular. What was it like to work in that building?
It wasn't the happiest period of my life. I think I didn't perform that well either. I didn't manage to gel in very well with the people who were there. As a result, I couldn't really get this big excitement I was getting at in Maranello. So it wasn't an experience that worked very well with me. So yeah, the building, all of that was spectacular. And, you know, I learned a lot there. There were some extremely capable people. But it just wasn't, at that time, my cup of tea.
One of the people you worked at there was Adrian Newey. He's an aero guy. You're an aero guy. What makes Adrian so special?
Well, he obviously knows much better than everybody else what makes him so special. I do think that, you know, the bits I saw of him, he did convince me of his reputation being justified. He was extraordinary in understanding the crux of a problem and coming up with innovative solutions. And I found that capacity just incredible out of him.
The MP420 in 2005 was spectacularly fast. I think it won 10 out of the 19 races that year, but a bit unreliable. How do you remember that year?
Well, I remember the excitement there at the car after a disastrous 2004 actually being so competitive in 2005. I wouldn't now, or didn't back then, claim any credit of that. I mean, I worked a bit on that, but I didn't feel it was something I could be that proud about, because I felt it was much more an Adrian car and his work. So, yeah, that's all.
When we're talking about Adrian, I find it interesting because in your current role and you're thinking up new regulations, is a little bit of you thinking, how's Adrian going to deal with this? I need to second guess Adrian Newey.
No, not really, but occasionally, yes, I guess.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Now, you then go back to Ferrari, but you said right at the start that this second period was a very happy time for you.
Some would.
But it had changed. Ross Brawn had gone and Jean Todt had taken a step back. Just how different was that Ferrari Mark II?
Well, it was different because, first of all, when I went back, they had had one or two bad years and they had the attitude that, you know, we've been dominating and winning almost every race with Michael Schumacher. And somehow teams get this sense of entitlement that somehow this is their own right to win. And they were not winning for a couple of years, and therefore they were a bit upset about it. So that had changed a bit the dynamics. I was in a different position. I was in a more senior role. And I had more time to get involved in much wider area than just aerodynamics. And the first car I was responsible for in that role was the 2007 car which managed to win the championship with Kimi and the constructors. So all of that was immensely satisfying, I would say, especially those first 2 years.
And Kimi had inherited the mantle from Schumacher in a way, hadn't he? Schumacher had retired at the end of 2006. Kimi comes in as the next big guy. Just how different were the approaches of those two guys?
Well, very different, because Kimi didn't have the intensity or the patience to speak with engineers, to do all of that. But I have extremely fond memories of Kimi. One is because we sort of shared that championship in 2007. So for me, the first guy was in that role, and him, the championship he won with Ferrari when he, as soon as he arrived. I have extremely fond memories of his sense of humor, his general attitude, and he was exceptionally talented. But I think he didn't quite enjoy so much all the, say, the engineering side of the sport.
But was good at telling you what the car was doing?
Yes, by that time, of course, and more recently, I guess, telemetry has come much more strong than it was back in the 90s. So, yes, Kimi was very good at telling us what he felt was needed. But I think by that time also we got a lot more from telemetry.
And then Fernando Alonso comes in 2010, another of the big guns. Why do you think Alonso didn't win a title at Ferrari?
Well, he came very close, I think, three times. And it is one of my biggest regrets that we didn't give him the car to win the championship, because even though he came close, Red Bull were outperforming us at that time. So in my view, Fernando should have won, you know, on pure talent, many more championships than he did eventually win, or maybe he could still win some, of course. So it's one of my regrets that he didn't. You know, if you analyze different championships, there was different reasons for which we were not that good. I think that we never got the blown exhaust quite right back in those years. We had quite a lot of internal debates in Ferrari between the chassis people and the engine people about getting the maximum exhaust effect on the engine. And I feel that we never got our engine to just quite produce as much strong exhaust flow as some other engines. And back then, that was championship deciding.
There's some stat. People are going to write in if I get this wrong. But I think Fernando said he's something like 5 points shy of being a five-time world champion. That's how close he got in that period. Yeah. And every time we go to Abu Dhabi now, I still find myself thinking of that 2010 race.
Well, I still think about that.
Do you wake up in the night thinking of things like that?
I don't wake up in the night now, but there are some key traumas, let's say, in my racing career, which are still, I still get pissed off about, and Abu Dhabi is one of them. And back then, I had this, after this loss and this huge disappointment, I had this, for a few months later, I had this recurring dream. And I don't normally dream about racing cars and work, but I had somehow it happened, and I would dream that somebody was saying, no, the race has been annulled, it's got to be done again. But of course, then I would wake up.
And then the final chapter for you on that side of the fence came with Manor just a few years later. When you've worked at McLaren and you've worked at Ferrari and had all their resource, does it feel like a different formula when you're at a team like Manor?
Yeah, it was a very different level. It had some very good people, but it was so under-resourced, so much of a shoestring operation that it just couldn't compete at any proper level. And then, of course, I did 1 year there, and it ran out of money. So, yeah, it's obviously a different level. I was always thinking that even, you know, if a member of the public came even to Manor, they would be impressed by some technology there. So I think it's, some people see the grid and you see, you know, the pole position, I don't know, Verstappen, and the last position, I don't know which car. And they think that these guys at the back probably don't know what they're doing. But in the reality, even the people at the back are a very impressive operation and very impressive outfit.
Do you think Manor would still be here if we'd had the budget cap that we know now in place back then?
I think they were a long way from even that budget cap. So I think they would have probably struggled. If they'd had one or two good results and managed to inject a bit more money and then put more investment in, maybe yes. But I think they were a long way away back then.
Nicholas, I'm quite interested in the budget cap and how it affects the way the teams go about their business, because I've been quite surprised at how long it's taken some of the teams to catch Red Bull, for example, in this current era of regulation. And do you think that is partly due to the cost cap? If there'd been no cost cap, if this was 2007, do you think the field would have converged faster?
Not so sure, because if you think of the domination periods of Mercedes before Red Bull, of Red Bull before Mercedes, and say of Ferrari in the early 2000s, or even if you go back to Williams or whatever, it did take a few years before people could understand. I think very much the reason people dominate is organization, clearly understanding the regulations well, as I say, having this calm to think ahead in the long term. And I don't think the cost cap has made it slower to converge. After all, Red Bull started dominating in the middle of 2022, and now we're in the middle of 2024, so it's about 2 years, and we are getting to a point where people can challenge. I don't think that's extraordinarily long.
Let's end where we started, talking about the new regulations. Do you think it'll be a very competitive field straight out of the box, or do you think one team could end up stealing a march?
I don't know. Clearly, my hope is that it will be very competitive out of the box. My hope is we'll have different teams winning and periods when they go up and down and so on. I think invariably with new rules, there will be somebody who gets it wrong and who finds himself in a rather embarrassing spot to start with. But I do think we're putting some things together to make sure it's more competitive in the long run.
Will you be nervous, do you think? I'm just envisaging
I'm always nervous for these things. Until we see something actually delivering, I think you can never be sure.
Well, exciting times ahead. If we could just end in the traditional way now on Beyond the Grid, which is with our quick fire questions.
Oh dear.
What else are you good at?
Sculpture, I think.
Keep it in the family?
A bit, yes, yeah. And a bit of chess, but not so much.
Which racing person, dead or alive, would you like to be stuck in a lift with?
It's a difficult one. I guess some of these engineers in the sort of 70s or so, Colin Chapman, maybe. I remember I wrote an essay about Colin Chapman when I was at school. We had to write an essay about somebody we admire. I wrote one about Colin Chapman back then, so I guess him.
What did you admire about Colin Chapman, even back then?
Well, it's a fact. You know, he started all this aerodynamic revolution, and he was making his cars, and, you know, he was owning the company, but designing the cars and all of that. All of that, I guess, found fascinating.
Who would play you in a film?
I don't know, somebody
I've
handsome.
Got an idea.
Somebody handsome?
No, of course.
I don't know.
Please take this the right way, but I've got this feeling. Javier Bardem.
I don't even know who he is, I'm afraid.
He plays baddies quite a lot.
Oh, really? Okay.
But more of a visual thing rather than the roles he plays.
Okay. Well,
you're going to say Brad Pitt, though, aren't you?
I wasn't going to say Brad Pitt. I know where my talents are, and that's probably not the one.
Who is the coolest person in your contacts?
I guess I have some drivers in my contacts, and... Fernando, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, I think for people watching and listening to this, that's pretty near the top of the list. And final one, if you had a podcast like this, who would be your first guest?
I guess I'd take the current world champion. So I'd take Max, I guess.
Nicholas, thank you very much. It's been
great.
Thank
you very much.
Well, if we were both stuck in a lift with Colin Chapman, my first question to him would be about the Lotus 72. That car was perfection. But what an interesting conversation. I love Nicholas's story about his grandfather and the Yeti, and his disarming honesty about how success affected him at work. And as for the 2026 regulations, there's a lot to digest. There's no doubt that it's going to be a brave new world for Formula One. And I love how the FIA are taking a lead and trying new things to improve the sport, especially on environmental matters. Nicholas, many thanks for your time, and I'll see you at a race again soon. And as ever, please let me know what you thought of this conversation through all the usual means. Use the hashtag F1BeyondTheGrid or I'm at TomClarksonF1. And let's throw it back to last week's episode with Greg Maffei now. I enjoyed talking to him, and I thought Dom Aldridge summed it up well with this. Interesting to learn a bit more about Greg. While he's happy to admit that he's still learning about the sport, there's no doubt that he and Liberty have created stability from which the sport can continue to grow. I'm fascinated to hear what's next. Well, Dom, thanks for that. And on the topic of what's next, I hope you've learned a little bit more in this episode concerning the 2026 regulations. And one quick notice before I go, you can listen to F1 Nation's review of that thrilling Canadian Grand Prix with me and Natalie Pinkham on your podcast app now. Thanks very much for listening. I will, of course, be back next week with another great guest from the world of Formula One. But for now, F1 Beyond the Grid is produced by Formula One and Audioboom Studios. Until next time, keep it flat out.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
2025 marks the 60th anniversary of the first Honda Formula One victory in the 1965 Mexico Grand Prix. More than half a century later, the drive and innovation that powers Honda Racing still inspires everything Honda does, from F1 victories to the Civic Hybrid being named the 2025 North American Car of the Year. Honda Racing is leading the charge when it comes to innovation. And here's where it gets really cool. Every Honda-powered F1 car is packed with sensors, hundreds of them, all feeding live data straight back to the Honda Racing team in Sakura, Japan. We're talking about real-time analysis that helps engineers squeeze out every ounce of performance on the track. And the amazing part? That same cutting-edge thinking is making its way into the cars we drive every day, thanks to the expertise of Honda Racing engineers. Their work has led to advances like the hybrid technology now used in Honda's consumer vehicles. The 2025 Civic Sedan Hybrid is engineered for fun, from the racetrack to your driveway. Learn more about the Civic and the latest Honda innovations at Honda.com.
Tired of spills and stains on your sofa? WashableSofas.com has your back. Featuring the Anabay Collection, the only designer sofa that's machine washable inside and out, where designer quality meets budget-friendly prices. That's right, sofas start at just $699. Enjoy a no-risk experience with pet-friendly, stain-resistant, and changeable slip covers made with performance fabrics. Experience cloud-like comfort with high-resilience foam that's hypoallergenic and never needs fluffing. The sturdy steel frame ensures longevity, and the modular pieces can be rearranged anytime. Check out WashableSofas.com and get up to 60% off your Anabay sofa, backed by a 30-day satisfaction guarantee. If you're not absolutely in love, send it back for a full refund. No return shipping or restocking fees. Every penny back. Upgrade now at WashableSofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.